Now, at this point, a question may occur to some of you, especially, perhaps, those who have been students of Buddhism for some considerable time. Now, you may be thinking, or you may be wondering even, well, we've heard a lot about ethics, a lot about the criterion of morality, but what about the silas? What about the precepts? When we read about Buddhist ethical teaching, Buddhist morality, we're always being told about the silas, the precepts. So where do they come in? Where do they fit in here? The 5 silas, the 10 silas, and so on. Are these not surely lists of moral rules laid down by the Buddha to which we must conform? Haven't they been handed down to us, as it were, by the Buddha himself? So where do they come in? Where do they fit into the total picture? So one may say, well, in reply to the question, have they not been laid down by the Buddha, these silas, these sets of precepts? Well, the answer is yes and no. They've certainly been taught, certainly been recommended by the Buddha, but not laid down authoritatively, as the 10 commandments were, by God. What the Buddha says, in effect, is this. He says, a person who is enlightened, one who has gained Buddhahood, one who has reached and realized the plenitude of wisdom and the fullness of compassion, he will behave, inevitably, in such and such a way, because it's his nature, it's the nature of an enlightened being to behave in that way. And to the extent that you are enlightened, to that extent, you too will behave in that way. And if you're not enlightened, or to the extent that you're not enlightened, then the observance of the silas, the observance of the precepts, will help you experience for yourself that state of mind of which, normally, they are the natural expression. Now let me make this point clear with the help of an example. We say that an enlightened person, one who is a Buddha, is free from, let us say, craving. Free from selfish thirst. But we ourselves, we are full of craving, full of such selfish thirst for this and for that. For example, we crave, say, food of various kinds. We've got a liking for this and a liking for that. A preference for this and a preference for that. But suppose, just as an experiment, suppose we stop eating some of our favorite foodstuffs, whatever that may be. We give them up. We decide, well, we won't take them anymore. Very regretfully, very sorrowfully, we close the larder door and we resist temptation, whatever it may be, whether it's plum cake. I knew one Buddhist high priest who was wonderfully addicted to plum cake. And I was told when I went to see him, you could get anything out of him, any teaching or instruction, if you offered plum cake. or it might be, well, anything else. But whatever it is, right, we give it up for some time. So what happens? We may suffer for a little while. It may not be so very easy. It may be, in fact, quite hard going. But if we stick it out, if we banish those visions of plum cake, and so on, what happens? The craving is gradually reduced. The vision recedes into the distance, and sometimes it may happen that for hours on end, we don't think even once of plum cake. So, in this way, craving is reduced. And eventually we may reach a happy state where there's no craving at all. There's just no craving. We never think of that particular thing. Never think of having it or enjoying it. So our abstention from that then becomes no longer a disciplinary measure, no longer something we impose on ourselves. It becomes a genuine expression of the state of non-craving to which we have attained. Now the silas, the precepts, are not just lists of rules. When you read them in a book on Buddhism, I'm afraid they read just like that, lists of rules. The Buddha said, don't do this, don't do that, don't do something else. Huh? A whole long list of don'ts with a few do's at the end. And I'm afraid sometimes the impression is created that Buddhism is a very, very dreary and negative business, and that the Buddha was going around like an old killjoy, just trying to prevent people from having a good time. This is the sort of impression, if one isn't careful, that one may get from some books on Buddhism. But the silas, we may say, the precepts, are really, truly, just patterns of ethical behaviour. Patterns of ethical behaviour. They are the natural expressions of certain skillful mental states. In other words, the silas represent the pattern of behaviour, or a certain pattern of behaviour expressive of a certain person's skillful mental state. And we can find out how far or to what extent we've developed the mental states, the skillful mental states, by checking our behaviour against the silas, against the precepts. It provides you with a rough and ready check. So let us look, therefore, briefly, just at one or two of these sets of silas, or patterns of ethical behaviour. As lists of rules, they'll be familiar to many, so we need not spend too much time on them. And besides, we don't want to identify perfect action too closely with any of its specific expressions, however worthy and noble those may be. But first of all, just one observation. Different people's patterns of external behaviour, ethical behaviour, may be identical, but their mental states, the mental states behind the pattern, may be quite different. This sounds a bit complicated, but it's really very simple. For example, suppose three different people abstain from theft. They don't steal. The first person would like to steal. He's got the urge to take something. But he abstains, he doesn't do that, just out of fear of the police. This is the morality of lots of people we know. Now the second person has a sort of slight inclination towards dishonesty. For instance, when he's filling in his tax returns, he might be quite seriously tempted. But he restrains himself. He doesn't give himself the benefit of the doubt, because he's trying to lead a spiritual life. The inclination is there, but it's restrained. But the third person has completely eradicated craving. There's not even any tendency, any inclination to dishonesty in his case. So the first person, who abstains from theft out of fear of the police, he's only moral in the legalistic sense. The second person, we may say, who feels an inclination but overcomes it, is moral in the sense that he's practicing right action in the narrow sense. But only the third, one who abstains because there's no temptation even, no inclination in that direction, only he is really practicing fully perfect action.